I was a teenage arsonist. My school's on fire. It's exhilarating. Fire trucks are whipping their sirens around, and my whole high school is out on the football field, chattering excitedly, whispering in little groups, because we're missing class and, oh my goodness, firemen. The headmaster comes onto the green lawn and waves for our attention. He uses a megaphone to make an announcement. I'm barely listening. I'm looking at the buildings, trying to see smoke. The school will be okay, and there aren't any injuries, the headmaster is saying. Unfortunately, though, it appears that somebody has set this fire on purpose. I start paying attention, then. He's told me something I know already. Standing alone on the second floor of my school, goosebumps run up and down my skinny teenaged arms, because I'm the one who set my school on fire. It's an action movie. It's a joke we're all in on. When I tell this story now at parties with gold light and the bubbles in the glass, I tell it like an adventure. I try to work up some suspense and then a good punch for delivery. I tell it like it's funny. People cheer. They give me high fives. You're my hero, some strangers say. That takes balls, said one boy. Why'd you do that? That's the question I get the most over and over. How come? To get out of Spanish class is my answer, and that's a sort of truth. I really did hate Spanish class. The teacher had buzz blonde hair and walnut nails and eyes like a pig, and she always talked about the Hoosier State, in some twangy Midwest accent, and I still don't know what a fucking Hoosier is, but if I ever meet one, I will pick a fight for sure. But the Hoosiers aren't the reason. When the police asked, why'd you set the school on fire? My answer was not, no quiero la clase de Spanish. In fact, for a month or so, the police didn't ask me anything at all. For a month or so, I was getting away with it. These days, I work in a high school. I teach English in Istanbul to bored, antsy teenagers. The girls wear headscarves that match their handbags, and when I enter the classroom in the morning, I ask, how are you, students? And they answer in a big, exaggerated chorus, fine, thanks, and you? I ask them what they'll do on the weekends, and they shrug. They will play computer games, they tell me. They will study. On Friday, they will pray, and they hold out their arms, bent at the elbow, hands raised and palms in. It's not the kind of prayer I'm used to, but I nod and nod, trying to understand. Tell me about your holidays, I say in slow, careful English. Tell me about Ramadan. They explain to me about fasting, about Bayram, about how they give meat to the poor after they cut cow. We don't cut cow, I correct them. We slaughter. Everybody repeat, slaughter, 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 slaughter. Good. So this is my way of trying to understand them. It's sloppy and embarrassing, but every time a student tells me something new, there is a map in my brain with some new territory lighting up. I start every class like that. Tell me things, I say over and over. Tell me about yourselves. Anything you want. Tell me what you'd like. Just raise your hand. When I was a student in that ill-fated high school, I was not some violent cast-out. I wanted to meet people. True, I was new at the school. I just moved south from New England, and I was still adjusting. But I joined the cross-country team at my mom's behest, and I met some girls that way. Beth was blonde and pretty, and had a wry sense of humor that set her apart from the other girls in the private, expensive, country day school. She wore black t-shirts and drove her own car. She had something called lupus, and she listened to heavy metal. She gave me a Tool CD and took me to Krispy Kreme. She was friendly, and I wanted desperately to be her friend. I wore ripped-up jeans and made elaborate doodles in my class notebooks. I was good in class, didn't drink, didn't do drugs, had never even been to a party. When Beth and I talked, we made plans about the future, about how we'd get out of that town. Or we talked about Nirvana, or running, or a vampire story she was going to write. The wanting of friendship was always there. But the easiness that came with real friendship never appeared. Silences in conversation made me afraid, and I'd ask questions I knew I'd asked before, repeat conversations we'd already had. Do you think Courtney loved it? Where would you go if you could go anywhere? What's better, Krispy Kreme or Dunkin' Donuts? She was my best friend because she was my coolest friend. When I wasn't trying to talk to Beth, I walked quickly through the school halls, keeping my head down. No one ever bullied me. No one tried to make me feel bad. I miss my old home in Massachusetts only as an afterthought. And when anyone asked, I would tell them, I'm fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. When students come to visit me in the English faculty room, I imitate the teachers who have already been there for years. I appraise them with cold eyes, answer their questions sternly, get them to speak in whole English sentences. Even the students who are loud in class come in sheepish, frightened looking. I say, "What do you want? Speak up." But I don't want to talk to them that way. I want them to tell me stories. I want them to complain. I want to kiss them on the top of the head like we still do with the kindergartners. When it snows and school closes early, I rush into the courtyard with the rest of the students. I pack a snowball with red, chapped hands, and I call it Hussein, and I hurl it at one of my students, laughing. It's the best I can do. At home, wrapped up near my space heater, I call the person I miss back home. We talk about my class, about his work in construction, about the city I left, the one he still lives in. I want to say, you look so tired. Is there anything you need? I want to say, I'm sorry I had to leave you there. I'm sorry that you're on your own. I'm sorry your mother died and that I don't know what that's like. I wish I could make it easier for you. You work too hard. You work every day. Take your broken hand to a doctor, for Christ's sake. I'll give you the money. I'll do anything to make it easier on you. Life should be easy for you. You are the best man I know. But I can't say those things. Instead, we ask the same questions. How's the weather? How's work? Is everything okay? Are you sure? I miss you too, every day. Everything's okay here too. So I didn't set my high school on fire because I was surrounded by malicious, wisecracking friends pre-pressuring me into doing something foolish. It was something I did alone. I was in study hall, with a lighter in my shoe. There wasn't anyone I knew in that class, and the teacher didn't pay very much attention. 20 minutes into class, I left the room and wandered upstairs. I went into the girls' bathroom, entered a stall, and pulled out handfuls of toilet paper. I took the lighter from my shoe, flicked it once, twice, and held it to the paper. The fire singed the thin tissue and then caught, turning from a little nail-sized flame to a fistful, and bigger, and when smoke started to curl up from the pile, I dropped it and hurried out, back down the stairs and into my seat, shaking and frightened and excited. I waited 20 minutes. I was expecting to hear the alarm, for something tremendous to happen, for a change that would knock a new direction in my life. When nothing happened, I left the room again and went back upstairs. The fire had gone out. I tried once more. This time it stuck. 10 minutes later, the fire alarm went ringing, and I got up with the rest of the students to file out of the school. A girl had gone to use the bathroom, and when she'd opened the door, great curls of smoke came billowing out. She'd pulled the fire alarm herself. The truck showed up soon. We could hear their sirens a long way off. It's a success, in a way. Spanish class is canceled. There is a girl in one of my classes in Istanbul with limp, dirty hair and a downcast face. She seems quiet, unassuming. When I have one of the boys in that class use one of our vocabulary words in a sentence, hate, he stands up, grinning, and points to her. I hate Nimet, ugh! And he sits back down again. The rest of the boys laugh and nod and agree. The girl keeps looking at her desk, half-smiling alongside them, like maybe she's in on the joke. The next word is insect. One of the boys stands up. Spiders, insect, like Nimet, ugh! And the other boys laugh. After class, I pull them aside and speak to them in a voice cold and solid as a stone. We don't ever, ever say that we hate one of our classmates. It's rude, and it's disrespectful. How would it make you feel if I said I hated you? It would make you feel bad, right? The boys nod. I'm not sure how much they understand. They are elbowing one another. If I hear you say you hate a student again, I will kick you out of my class. And I tell them to go on, get. I pull Nima aside too. I'm sorry that happened, I say softly. It won't happen again. Okay, she is still smiling, looking at the floor. Are you all right? Do you want to talk about it? But this is a false offer, because we both know her English is not good enough to talk about it with me, even if she wanted to. She shrugs, still with that almost smile, and when I take my hand from her shoulder, she walks out of the classroom, not saying a word. For 1 month, I think that they won't figure it out. I don't tell anybody about the fire I set, about the flames licking up, and there aren't any cameras inside the school. At a lunch with the cross-country team, the subject of the arson comes up again. It's a popular conversation. They're talking about suspects, about rumors. They're saying the kid who did it stuffed burning wool up into the ceiling tiles to try and make the fire spread, to bring the whole building down and kill the students. Yeah, we're lucky we got out alive. Are you okay? The team captain, Mackenzie, asked me in the middle. I hadn't realized my face was anything but blank. Oh, sure, I answer quickly. I was just worried about whoever it is that must have set the fire. They must be really upset about something. She nods and turns back to the group. I congratulate myself on the quick lie. Eventually, trying to be cool, I slip up and tell a kid in my driver's education class. Word spreads around fast, and soon after that, my mom calls me on my way home. Police are here, asking about you, she says on the phone, her voice shaking. They think you had something to do with that fire. The cop is waiting in my living room when I get there, talking to my mom like he's a friend. I sit down and he says straight out, Listen, I'm not here to mess you up. Now we know you set that fire. We have a lot of evidence. I can't say what it is, but I can tell you that if you cooperate, I'm going to go to bat for you. If you can give us a statement, it'll go really smooth. We want this to be painless. I don't know what you're talking about, I say fast and hot. I can feel my eyes go big and false round. It goes on like this for hours. I keep saying that I don't know, I'm just tired, I want to go to bed. When they finally let me leave, I sit on the stairs and listen to my mom saying, She's a good girl, she's never done anything like this. I'm sure some of those kids blamed it on her just because she's new. She wouldn't do something like this. I can hear her heart shredding up in her throat. I lie on my bed, wide awake, for hours. This is a funny story. It's a story I tell because of the high fives, the white teeth flashing in the lamplight when friends laugh out loud, saying, Wow, saying, I wish I'd done that. It's a quirk. It's cute. But there has been one time, once in my entire life, that I have found myself completely alone. It was in 2004, at the age of 16, when I lay in my room and realized that no one was going to help me, that I was going to break my family's heart, that I'd be kicked out of school, that everyone I knew in the whole state would suddenly see me as some insane criminal, an arsonist, that I'd have a record, that I might go to juvie, could get taken away from my home. Now nothing would ever be the same, and I brought this on myself. It was my own fault. There was nothing I could do. This was the worst hour. It is still the worst hour. But this is a funny story. When I called the police officer back to make my confession, I remember Taps was playing on the radio, and I was like, ha ha, really? And the radio was like, ha ha, really? My statement, when I wrote it in blue pen, sitting cross-legged on my mother's bed, contained a lot of curses and a couple doodles. To this day, when I hear somebody use the term go to bat for, I want to slap them on the mouth. So I was expelled, I was arrested, everything changed, and I walked around my quiet house, past my quiet family, like I had already died. I never spoke to Beth again. She never called, not once, not to ask what happened or to see how I was. The cop, my family, my friends these days at the parties, they keep asking, why did you do that? What for? And I could say, Los motherfucking Hoosiers. I could say I was bored, I was angry, I just moved and my dad had gotten remarried and I hated cross country and I went to see the Polar Express and I cried and cried and cried. I could say these things, but they don't make a very fun story, so I don't. A 16-year-old is supposed to talk a lot. A 16-year-old is supposed to gab and chat for hours about nothing, twirling the phone cord around their finger. But this is not really talking, not truly. When we are teenagers, we don't know how to talk to people. We barely understand how to speak. We hardly know what we're thinking, so how are we supposed to explain it to somebody else? Because talking to another person is the hardest thing in the world. It took years of practice for me to learn how to do it. And now, even though I teach it, even though I'm supposed to be putting conversations into the mouths of a new generation of teenagers, I still don't quite know how. It takes practice for years and years and years. I'm still learning how to be a person with other people. I'm still, even now, a student in that way.